Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated January 14, 2011. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's front page, top of the fold, Despite Cuts, Colleges in Sound Fiscal Shape, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. They may have tightened their belts, but area public universities have gotten bigger in the 12 months that ended June 30th. Audits by North Carolina State Auditor Beth Wood's office show that UNC Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and East Carolina University all increased net assets in fiscal 2010, with UNC growing its assets line the most to $3.7 billion, up by $240 million, or 7.2% over the prior year. NCSU's net asset bottom line rose by 6% to $1.5 billion. ECU's rose by 4.4% to $801 million. Net assets represent what's left over when a not-for-profit subtracts its total liabilities from its total assets. Growth recorded in any year is carried forward to the next year. The audits are performed by staffers in Wood's office and take a look at the complete range of university financing, says auditor spokesman Dennis Patterson. Richard Mann, UNC Chapel Hill's vice chancellor for finance and administration, agrees the state's flagship school finished fiscal 2010 in solid condition. "We worked to maintain financial integrity, and we were able to accomplish that," says Mann, adding that his immediate concerns now lie more with what's coming next. That's because with the state now looking at a $3.7 billion budget shortfall in 2011, the universities are expected to be included in the pain. Mann says he and his staff are preparing for all contingencies, but adds, "It really starts to get tough when you look at anything above a 5% cut." NCSU managers are also trying to anticipate the future. If upcoming state cuts hit the 10% range, they say in a note included in Wood's audit, quote, "Such reductions, if made, would be significant to university operations. Attention to removing redundancies and underperforming programs, as well as reducing spending and improving revenue streams where available, will be evaluated during the budget decision process," end quote. The writer of the NCSU note was not identified. Whatever might lie ahead for the schools in 2011, the Wood audits show how they managed in fiscal 2010. Despite lean times in Raleigh, state contributions to all three institutions actually rose in fiscal 2010 as lawmakers continued to fund growth. At UNC, the state contribution figure inched higher by a mere 0.6% to $542 million. NCSU fared better with a 23% increase to $472 million, while at ECU, state appropriations rose by 9% to $263 million. As for various actions at the individual schools, to make ends meet, UNCCH collected 5% more in tuition from students, snagged 10% more in mostly federal grants, and upped its charges for housing, utilities, and a host of other services by 6.7%. The school's revenue picture was eased by a nearly 3% increase in gifts and by endowment investment returns of $104 million, up 134% from the prior year. On the spending side, UNCCH increased salaries and benefits to its employees by 2.4% to $1.34 billion and gave out 18% more to $69 million in scholarships. NCSU, meanwhile, also collected 5.3% more in student tuition, but held the line on housing and other charges. Salaries and benefits fell by 1% to $713 million, while scholarships rose by nearly 13% to $41 million. ECU upped salaries by 1.1% to $471 million. On the revenue side, the school collected 7% more in tuition, but cut housing and related service charges by 10%. ECU's Vice Chancellor of Finance, Rick Niswander, while characterizing the year as a challenging one, says the university ended in solid fiscal shape. Next up, Bank of America sued over loan insurance, by Chris Basden, from Cary. Already beset by a mountain of criticism over foreclosures and bailouts, Bank of America is facing a new issue raised by Triangle homebuyers who claim the Charlotte lender bought mortgage insurance on loans it made to them without their knowledge. A lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina centers around no-fee mortgage plus loans that Bank of America started making around the country in 2007. The loans were marketed as a way for homebuyers to obtain a mortgage without having to pay fees and without having to purchase mortgage insurance, according to the complaint. Yet B of A did purchase lender-paid mortgage insurance on the loans without informing customers, according to the complaint. The lawsuit claims that in addition to violating a federal disclosure law, B of A's covert purchase of mortgage insurance was a problem for customers in two ways. First, the lawsuit contends B of A passed the cost of insurance on to consumers. Secondly, the terms and conditions of the insurance could prevent borrowers from refinancing their loans. The plaintiffs in the case discovered that they had the insurance after they unsuccessfully tried to refinance their loans to take advantage of lower interest rates. This becomes a weight around someone's neck, Jim White, one of the plaintiff's lawyers, says, of lender-paid mortgage insurance. There's a good reason why banks want insurance on home loans. Having mortgage insurance makes it easier to securitize a loan because investors will feel protected. Instead of keeping a home loan that is made, a bank often packages a bunch of them together in a process called securitization, and then sells them as investment paper. The lawsuit was filed by Cary resident Mark Augustin and Henderson husband and wife, Robert and Jeanne Keel, on January 4th. Its allegations include fraud, negligent misrepresentation, and violation of the Homeowners Protection Act of 1998. The plaintiffs are seeking class action status for the lawsuit. "We think that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in the program," says White. A phone inquiry to a Bank of America spokesman resulted in an email reply from Bank of America's Shirley Norton. "We still have not been served with the suit, but believe that it is without merit," Norton wrote. Hi Nguyen, a spokeswoman for the NC Commissioners of Banks, says that regulatory body doesn't have any specific complaint data regarding fees related to lender-paid mortgage insurance. Damian Blue, an attorney at Blue, Stevens & Fellers, who also is representing the plaintiffs, declined to comment on the case. With millions on the line, North Carolina nonprofits are gearing up for a fight. By James Gallagher. From Raleigh. The North Carolina Center for Nonprofits is gearing up for a battle to protect state funding for nonprofits. The organization, which represents the interest of nonprofit organizations in a state with more than 10,000 of them, is concerned that state legislatures will quickly target small nonprofits that cannot afford lobbyists, as it works to erase a projected $3.7 billion budget shortfall. Small nonprofits or service agencies, which give better bang for the buck than state agencies, are often the easier ones to cut, says David Heinen, Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Center. Among those most expected to be targeted for cuts are healthcare organizations that provide optional Medicaid services such as personal care, case management, hospice care, adult care, or transportation. Heinien and others at the center are lobbying legislatures and readying themselves to respond to issues that arise during the budget process. At this point, no organizations or areas have been identified for cuts. State Senate Richard Stevens, a Wake County Republican, says nothing is off the table. All organizations will be looked at, he says, adding that in this environment, some nonprofits may not be able to be funded at all. Edwin McClanahan of the North Carolina Justice Center says he has heard talk that optional Medicaid services is one area likely to be targeted. While Medicaid is federally mandated, states are not required to fund all aspects of the program, such as personal care services, hearing aids, hospice care, or prescription drugs. The state contracts out many of those services to nonprofit organizations and could cut them without losing matching federal dollars. Brad Dean, a spokesman for the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, says that the state currently receives about three federal dollars for each dollar it spends on Medicaid. For the 2011 fiscal year, the state plans to spend almost $9.8 billion total on Medicaid services, with about $3.8 billion going to optional services. Dean notes that in many cases, Medicaid patients have other outlets for care, such as hospital emergency departments that are not optional, and those other options can be more expensive in the long run than the optional services. The state does not track how much money it provides to nonprofits in grants and contracts, but the number is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. In grants alone, which do not include contracted services, the state provided more than $360 million in fiscal 2010, down 26% from the year before, according to figures compiled by the North Carolina Justice Center. And nonprofits, ranging from hospitals to universities to healthcare organizations, employ about 400,000 people across the state. Still on the front page, Centerpoint. Downtown bound? Red Hat could change downtown Raleigh's skyline with its own tower. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Raleigh. Downtown Raleigh could be the biggest benefactor of Red Hat's decision to build and expand the headquarters of its open-source software company in Wake County. Several real estate sources say that the publicly traded technology company may have started visioning a downtown tower emblazoned with the company's trademark Red Fedora at the top. As part of its decision-making process, Red Hat asked local real estate development groups to submit proposals for a building project of at least 300,000 square feet, or the equivalent of a 15- to 20-story office building. Add residential units and retail spaces, and the project could go up as high as 30 stories, similar to the RBC Plaza on Fayetteville Street. Red Hat officials so far are mum on specifically where in Wake County they want to invest the $109 million that they promised state and county government officials that they would spend to make room for the next 540 new jobs they plan to create over the next few years. If the company meets its job creation and investment goals, it could receive nearly $20 million in state and local economic development incentives over the next 12 years based on the deal announced January 10th. Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen says he had heard that different developers had proposed building plans for two city-owned parking lot sites in front of the Progress Energy Performing Arts Center, but he has seen no formal proposal for either of the sites. "We are not actively marketing those sites right now," Allen says. "Occasionally we get a little developer interest and they come talk to us, but there are no active negotiations taking place right now." The city has five surface parking lots in downtown Raleigh that have been offered for sale in the past, but private developers of most downtown properties has languished in the wake of the economic downturn. Derek Miner, director of downtown development for the Downtown Raleigh Alliance, says he had heard that seven different proposals were pitched to Red Hat for properties in the downtown district, including Craig Davis's Properties Charter Square joint venture project on Fayetteville Street, Greg Sandreiter's high-rise addition tower project on Davy Street, and the city's Site 3 parking property between City Plaza and the Progress Energy Center for the Performing Arts, which had garnered interest from both Highwoods Properties of Raleigh and Capital Associates of Cary. Frank Baird, a partner at Capital Associates, says he and others who submitted proposals to Red Hat were told not to talk about the project. "My guess is it will be a while before they decide," Baird says. Ken Atkins, executive director of Wake County Economic Development, who helped negotiate the terms of the county incentives grant, says he is not sure which municipality in Wake County will eventually get the green light. "But the chosen city or town will have to match the county's grant for the company," Atkins says. "Our focus was on the incentives piece, and I don't know a lot about which properties they were looking at," he adds. Bill Sandridge, a real estate broker with the Jones Lang LaSalle firm in Raleigh, is representing Red Hat in its property search. but Sandridge did not return calls for comment. Neither did officials from Red Hat. According to several office building developers, the company is still considering proposals for properties at North Hills in North Raleigh, Weston in Cary, and Perimeter Park in Morrisville, as well as sites on NC State University's Centennial Campus, where Red Hat's headquarters are currently located. The company employs about 690 people at Centennial Campus in two office buildings with about 180,000 square feet. Dennis Kikas, Associate Vice Chancellor for the Centennial Campus Partnership Office at NC State, says Red Hat has always been a strong partner on campus, helping sponsor and host technology programs for students, which he expects will continue even if the company moves off campus. "We are hopeful we will still be competing with other options in the region, but there are a number of players sitting on pins and needles wanting to know what their next move will be," Kikas says. Inside the front cover, betting on the new board. Duke gets 11 members, Progress gets 7. By Chris Basden. From Raleigh. Progress Energy will have to slash its 14-member board in half by early March and give the names to Duke Energy as the merged utility draws up operational plans for the future. That means a couple of big names in local business may find out in less than 2 months if they will be invited by Progress to join the 11 members of the Duke Energy Board to form the new team. Although Progress will have to deliver the names to Duke by March 20th, the Raleigh Utility's current 14-member board will continue to operate until shareholders and regulators approve the $26 billion deal. The merged company will have a board with 18 members, 11 of whom will come from Duke, which currently has an 11-member board. Progress will get 7 slots on the combined board. The companies have announced that one of those Progress slots will go to Progress CEO Bill Johnson, who will be the CEO of the new Duke Energy, leaving 6 seats open. Other than Johnson, former First Citizens President Jim Hyler and former UNC CH Business School Dean Steve Jones are the only Progress board members who reside in the Triangle. Hyler, in a brief phone conversation, said he wasn't at liberty to discuss anything involving Progress. Attempts to reach Jones were unsuccessful. "It's not yet determined how the members will be chosen from our side," says Progress spokesman Mike Hughes in an email response to questions. "The money's not all that much for most of those who circle in the rarefied air of Fortune 500 company boards. It generally is the influence and the power that attracts them to sitting on the top floor boardroom, making decisions for thousands of employees and doing deals worth billions of dollars." Corporate governance insiders can guess at some of the criteria that will be used to cull Progress's existing board down to 7. Sue Tierney, a managing principal at Boston-based consulting firm Analysis Group, expects the company to look for strong, active board members who can play a role for a number of years. That means that age could be a factor in the decision-making process. Duke has said in an SEC filing that the normal retirement age for directors at the combined company will be age 71. While the compensation for directors at the combined company hasn't been determined, Duke's annual board retainer currently sits at $50,000 in cash and $100,000 worth of stock. Directors also earn more by attending meetings and serving in special posts, such as chairing committees. None of the Progress board members have reached the age of 71 yet, but the merger is not expected to be completed until the end of this year. At the time of its most recent proxy statement, which was filed in the first half of 2010, Progress's oldest directors were 68-year-old John Mullen III and 67-year-old Alfred Tolleson, Jr. Mullen is the chairman of farming and timber management firm Ridgeway Farm, LLC, while Tolleson is the retired chairman and CEO of the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. Tierney says that both boards also look for diversity, both in terms of skills and experience as well as factors such as gender. Duke's board currently has just one woman, Ann Maynard Gray, the former president of Diversified Publishing Group of ABC Incorporated. Progress, however, has two female board members, Mary McKee, the president of the Corning Museum of Glass, and Theresa Stone, the executive vice president and treasurer of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chiru Rahia, an assistant professor of management at Wake Forest University, thinks that Stone's gender and her background could both boost her chances of ending up on the combined board. There's a lot of talk about how power generation technology is changing, and academic researchers like those at MIT often are at the forefront of such developments. There are other reasons to like the female Progress board member's chances. According to an SEC filing, Progress will get to designate the chairs of the combined company's compensation committee and its audit committee. McKee is chair of Progress's existing organization and compensation committee, while Stone is the chair of the audit and corporate performance committee. Another board member whose potential stands out to Rahia, particularly given the government regulation of the industry, is Mel Martinez, a former U.S. senator from Florida. "You definitely want to have somebody with a political background," says Rahia. In contrast to the carnage at Progress, Duke's existing board should escape the merger relatively unscathed. The Charlotte utility only has 11 directors, a perfect fit for the 11 spots it receives in the combined company. Asked about the board spots, Duke spokesman David Scansoni points out that there could be changes at the company's annual meeting in early May. That meeting will occur many months before the acquisition's expected closing at the end of 2011. On the same page, "Personnel Cuts May Be Limited" by John Downey. From Charlotte, the $13.7 billion deal combining Duke Energy with Progress Energy could be done with significantly less pressure to cut personnel because the deal is expected to add to Duke's bottom line without the need for deep cost cuts. And customers in the Carolinas are likely to benefit in future years because fuel savings the companies project could hold future rate increases to a minimum. One analyst, Nathan Judge of London-based Atlantic Equities, says the cost may be sufficient to hold increases that were expected to be in double digits into the low single digits. And if the new Duke can deliver the kind of savings that ease rate concerns among regulators, it is possible the unusual merger of neighboring utilities could become a model for other utilities going forward. "The case is likely to send some important signals to the industry," says Steve Piper, Associate Director of Power Markets for SNL Financial in Charlottesville, Virginia. "We may learn if regulators agree that increased scale is going to be important for utility stability and how geographically diverse a deal has to be." Most utility deals in the past have involved utilities going into new territories. Progress and Duke both followed that pattern. Progress moving into Florida in its last big merger, and Duke moving into the Midwest. Piper says this is a new kind of merger, in some ways as big a departure as Duke's ill-fated move into the broader energy markets in 1997 with the purchase of Pan Energy Corporation. But Duke and Progress argue this merger of utilities, situated right next to each other, allows unique opportunities for saving operating and fuel costs. The industry may know soon. Duke plans to file for rate increases in both Carolinas this year. Regulators say the Progress deal is unlikely to affect the increases granted in both those rate hikes. But Duke's Scott of the Office of Regulatory Staff in South Carolina says the operating savings Duke forecast could hold down future increases. Robert Gruber, Executive Director of Public Staff of the North Carolina Utilities Commission, says he doesn't expect the kind of rate rebates and rollbacks that accompanied Duke's $9 billion purchase of Synergy. But he says his staff will be examining the merger application when it's filed, likely in March, to see what savings should be passed on to customers in future rate hearings. He says it's even possible that regulators could mandate that Duke and Progress file for new rate reviews after the merger to make sure customers get their share of the savings. Details have been hard for regulators and customer advocates to come by. Duke and Progress say they foresee $600 million to $800 million in dual cost savings over the first 5 years of the combined operations. After the Monday announcement of the deal, Duke Chief Financial Officer Lynn Good told analysts there could also be savings of $300 million to $400 million per year in non-fuel operating costs. Those savings would make the deal accretive for Duke in the first year. It is not yet clear how much of those non-fuel savings Duke would return to customers. The built-in savings means Duke won't have to pursue the kind of aggressive cost-cutting that led it to eliminating 1,500 positions when it merged with Synergy, Judge says. I would not expect the kind of headcount reductions that are typical of mergers, he said. But disputes remain about the deal. Analyst Angie Storeski of Macquarie Research contends that Duke isn't paying enough to Progress to compensate its shareholders for increased risk to future earnings. Analyst Patrick Goff of Morningstar Incorporated argues that Duke actually is paying a little more for Progress than what the company is worth, based on Morningstar's assessment of the fair market value of the two companies. Certainly the small premium Duke has offered over the recent stock price for Progress has raised some eyebrows, but Piper says Progress needed this deal more than Duke. His argument is that Progress's need grows out of the changing structure of the energy industry. Electric rates are rising with the need to build new plants and infrastructure. Piper says the industry is coming to the conclusion that utilities will need a minimum size to ensure stability. He says that size would be a generating capacity of around 25 gigawatts to 30 gigawatts. Duke, at more than 35 gigawatts, already has the scale it needs. Progress, at around 22 gigawatts, falls short. Duke and Progress have put out few details on savings they would seek to get from the merger beyond those more than efficient operations. The companies say some jobs will be eliminated, and Duke's CEO Jim Rogers says they have come up with some ballpark figures on additional savings. But the companies are not prepared to discuss them now. Still, they have made it clear that they will continue to operate Duke Energy Carolinas and Progress Energy Carolinas as separate operating companies. And there have been indications that most job cuts will come at the parent company level, Duke Energy Corp. and Progress Energy Incorporated, rather than at the operating level of the Carolinas utilities. Progress wrote separate letters to employees of the Energy Supply Division, which operates the power plants, and Progress Energy Service Company Incorporated, which includes the company's support personnel. The letter to the plant workers, while warning of job cuts, says most of our energy supply companies will be part of the combined company. The letter to the service company made no such statement. But continuing to operate Duke and Progress as separate utility companies with separate rates could cut down significantly on the back office savings, Gruber says. He says the public staff is still groping for information about what kind of savings customers might expect to share. We really don't know anything until they make the merger application, he says. Next up, Lab will give NCSU Solar Center new mission. By Frank Van Leeuwen from Raleigh. The North Carolina Solar Center, already firmly established in renewable energy circles, is now positioning itself to capture more solar testing business with a new lab that would be one of only five of its kind in the country. The Solar Center aims to get the lab accredited by the Solar Rating and Certification Corps, or SRCC, a standards body for the solar industry. Right now, just four such labs operate in the United States. As more solar products enter the market, the small number of labs has created a testing backlog that the Solar Center can tap. Tommy Cleveland, a solar energy engineer at the Solar Center, says the center aims to get the lab accredited and operational by summer. The Solar Center already does some solar testing, much of that custom or contract work for companies developing solar technologies. The new lab will test solar thermal equipment, used for heating water, against SRCC standards. The battery of tests evaluate the equipment's performance and durability in real-world situations and can take up to 3 months. While the solar industry is viewed as relatively new, SRCC's standards actually date to 1980, For years, two accredited labs, one in Florida and the other in Canada, handled most of the U.S. solar thermal testing, Cleveland says. But in 2007, a new solar federal tax credit was tied to SRCC standards. The tax credit boosted demand for lab time, leading to testing backlogs of up to 4 years. Backlogs at testing labs have been a matter of concern for manufacturers of solar products, says John Morrison, COO of Stratus Solar in Chapel Hill, and former Assistant Secretary of Energy in the North Carolina Department of Commerce. The wait times have eased with the opening of new testing labs, but the backlog continues. Bringing on an additional lab would shorten the wait for companies trying to bring new products to market, he says. The Solar Center's new lab is being paid for in part by a $100,000 grant from the North Carolina Green Business Fund from the Department of Commerce. The Solar Center is paying another $100,000 in equipment cost. While the Solar Center is located at NC State University, the budget is separate from the university's. The center's current budget includes $1.2 million in state appropriations, $4.6 million in targeted grants, and about $350,000 in fees for service and other work. Cleveland says that when the new lab is operational, it should be self-sustaining. The test will cost a solar equipment manufacturer about $10,000. Bob Kingery, a co-founder of Morrisville-based Southern Energy Management, which installs solar thermal as well as solar photovoltaic, says much of the new solar thermal equipment is coming from overseas, where labor costs are cheaper. But those manufacturers also want to get SRCC-accredited testing before they enter the U.S. market. Kingery says that bodes well for the Solar Center's new facility. A long-term source of revenue, and it gets them in touch with a lot of manufacturers who want to come to the United States, Kingery says. The following article is titled NCSU and $61 Million Energy Upgrade by James Gallagher from Raleigh. NC State University is moving forward with plans to make the campus more energy efficient and reduce its carbon output. The university has signed a $61 million deal with Framingham, Mass-based Amerisco to upgrade and renovate two steam and chilled water distribution facilities on North and Central campuses. The project is intended to make the systems more efficient and reduce the amount of carbon emissions emitted each year. Jack Colby, NCSU's Assistant Vice Chancellor for Facilities Operation, says the thermal process in the facilities will climb from 38% efficient to 75% efficient, and emissions will drop by 25,000 tons a year, for about a 9% reduction overall. Amerisco has guaranteed savings of $3.9 million within the first year and savings of $10 million per year by the end of the project, and the company is responsible for any issues that do not lead to such savings. As part of the contract, Amerisco, which is among the nation's largest independent energy services companies, will install a cogeneration unit that will allow the facilities to simultaneously generate steam and electricity. While the university uses steam to heat buildings, NCSU needs the water vapors year-round in various science labs. Amerisco also will replace two 60-year-old boilers with modern, more efficient models that use a more environmentally friendly oil. The project also will convert the facility to burn natural gas, which is how the university will cut its emissions. Becoming more energy efficient is one of the most cost-effective steps institutions can take, says Herb Eckerlund, a professor in NCSU's Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering. Improved efficiency can provide constant benefits, he says. The university is using an 18-year bonds to fund the project. The cost savings achieved through improved energy efficiency will pay for the bonds, says Kevin McNaughton, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. The move fits with UNC General Administration plans to reduce the amount of carbon emitted by the system's member institutions. The system has set a goal of being climate neutral by 2050. NCSU has done other projects to move it toward that goal. The university has already spent $19.7 million to retrofit 13 buildings with more energy-efficient systems, including lighting and heat and cooling systems. Next up, Triangle Colleges enjoying upswing in applications. Meredith on path to match its biggest class. By James Gallagher. From Raleigh, Meredith College is starting to see a rebound in student applications. A year after the college's applications and enrollment plummeted, the Women's College is on track to take in its second largest set of applications. "We're nearly to the level of our largest class, which was 2 years ago," says Danny Green, the college's associate vice president for enrollment. Green attributes the uptick to greater interest in Meredith, as well as increasingly crowded classes at public institutions. At this point, the college has received 1,165 applications, up 3.6% from this time last year. Green expects the final tally to be around 1,600. That should be enough to enroll a freshman class of 375 to 400 students, says Green, up from 366 this past fall. The greater number of applications does not mean larger classes. While Meredith plans to up its enrollment, its projected fall 2011 class is still smaller than its 2009 class, which totaled 478. The story playing out at Meredith largely is the same at universities across the Triangle. UNC Chapel Hill has received more than 17,750 applications at this point, about 10% more than a year ago, and is on track to take in more than 25,000. NC State has received 15,399 applications, up 5.8%. Stephen Farmer, Director of Admissions at UNC Chapel Hill, attributes the increase to the university's reputation for providing a top-notch education at an affordable price. He points to the institution's 10-year run as Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine's Best Value in Higher Education. Thomas Griffin, NCSU's admissions director, says the university intends to enroll about 4,400 students this year, down from about 4,550 from last year. Prior year budget cuts have forced NCSU to reduce the number of classes it offers and increase class sizes. The university is again going to experience budget cuts in the next fiscal year due to tight state finances. A lot of students applying to several colleges and then choose among those that accept them. For example, in-state students applying to UNCCH sent applications to a total of 5 colleges this year, up from 4 in 2003. Out-of-state students applied to 7 institutions this year, including UNCCH, up from 6 in 2003. Those numbers will rise once UNCCH begins accepting what's known as a common application, which is a standardized document accepted by about 300 institutions nationally. Since the expansion of that program, students have increased the number of institutions they apply to, with some submitting their credentials to 20 or more colleges. And now, state must keep borrowing to pay jobless. North Carolina already owes $2.4 billion to the feds. By Lee Westbecker, from Raleigh. The pot of cash that North Carolina uses to pay jobless benefits was $2.37 billion in the red as of November, leaving the state little option but to continue borrowing from the federal government to keep the program running in the coming months. From the beginning of the Great Recession through December 6, 2010, North Carolina has borrowed $2.4 billion from the feds to pay benefits. With statewide unemployment still hovering in the 9% range, more of the same is the order of the day. "I don't see that we have other choices," says David Clegg, Deputy Director of the Employment Security Commission of North Carolina, which administers the benefit system. North Carolina's level of federal borrowing puts it in fifth place nationally among 26 states whose trust funds were quickly exhausted by the pace of layoffs during the worst part of the recession in 2009. Since then, through early December 2010, those states have borrowed a total of $41 billion to keep their unemployment insurance, or UI, programs operating. In first place in the roster of states is California, which had borrowed $8.9 billion through early December. The data comes from a new status report on the North Carolina UI system by Kevin Carlson of ESC's Finance Division. Carlson recently briefed a group of state lawmakers on the facts and figures. Of primary interest to state officials and others is whether the federal largesse ultimately will have to be paid back. North Carolina's first interest payment on the federal loans, about $20 million, would have to be repaid in late 2011 unless Congress extends interest-free borrowing by states or cancels the debt altogether. Congress is also expected to debate a rate increase that would require businesses in North Carolina and in other states that have been borrowing heavily from the U.S. Treasury to pay at least 0.3% more in federal unemployment taxes, known as FUTA. Companies in South Carolina, Indiana, and Michigan already are contending with the federal rates. Here's how it works. Employers pay unemployment taxes to both the state and the IRS. State payments go to a North Carolina trust fund and are used only to pay the cost of jobless benefits to laid-off workers in the state. Employers pay a flat rate of 6.2% on the first $7,000 of each employee's annual wages on the federal portion, but also receive a 5.4% credit for making timely payments. That essentially brings the federal rate down to 0.8%. However, states that have borrowed money from the feds to pay benefits and whose loans have been outstanding for 2 years receive less credit for timely payments. The reduction in the federal tax credit is 0.3% for the first year and an additional 0.3% for each succeeding year until the loan is repaid. Under that formula, and if no congressional fix happens in the coming months, the federal tax burden North Carolina employers will face by the end of 2011 will increase from 0.8% to 1.1%. It's a prospect that has small business advocates on the alert. Anything that can affect the interest rates companies pay is of interest to us, says Stephanie Cathcart of the National Federation of Independent Businesses. As for the state portion of the UI tax, on average, employers pay 1.2% on a taxable wage base of $19,700. That would be up to the General Assembly to change the state schedule. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Nonprofit uses chess to help kids. From the philanthropy desk of Todd Cohen. 4 years ago, in the dining room of his North Raleigh house, engineer Bill Clausen started teaching chess to some neighborhood children. Today, that informal Raleigh Chess Academy has evolved into Chess Archives, into Chess Achieves, a nonprofit that uses the game as a tool to help kids develop confidence and learning skills. Operating with an annual budget of $85,000, Chess Achieves serves roughly 90 children at 6 schools in Wake County, most of them private elementary schools. And next month, Chess Achieves will serve as host to the annual North Carolina Scholastic Chess Tournament, an event expected to attract 500 kids from throughout the state to the Raleigh Convention Center. Chess is a form of logic, problem-solving, and discipline is a great way to motivate young people to think for themselves and to become better students, says Hector Perez, a co-founder and member of the board of directors of Chess Achieve and executive director of the Johnston Health Foundation in Smithfield. The statewide tournament, which is sponsored by the North Carolina Chess Association, a licensee of the United States Chess Federation, provides a great opportunity to showcase the quality of Chess Achieve's work, as well as the impact of chess has on children and its benefits to the community, Perez says. Clausen, whose father introduced him to the game at age 12, launched the first team at his own high school in Spring Hill, Florida. An engineer who has worked for Siemens, John Deere, Harley-Davidson, and Briggs & Stratton, mainly helping them put together assembly lines, Clausen says he was stunned there was almost no chess for kids in Wake County. After he and Perez first met 2 years ago at the Cardinal Chess Club and talked about the lack of local opportunities for kids to play chess, they decided to form Chess Achieves. Working in schools and at private space it rents, the group provides lessons once or twice a week, nearly always right after the school day ends. It also runs tournaments roughly every other Sunday afternoon, events that typically attract about 40 kids. And it has begun offering services outside Wake County. In December, for example, Chess Achieves held its first tournament in Johnston County, where it also has donated 100 tournament chess sets to 14 schools. And it has donated chess books to a public school in Durham County. Over the next 3 years, Clausen says, Chess Achieves aims to expand to 20 to 25 schools and a total of about 300 participants a year, growth that would increase its annual budget to between $125,000 and $150,000. The main expense would be paying $2,700 for an instructor at each school, as well as providing them with chess sets, boards, clocks, and other equipment. Chess, says Clausen, helps kids build confidence, learn how to solve problems, develop patience, and communicate ideas. Not only are we trying to teach children, he says, but we also realize that we have to get adults involved in this opportunity to teach children. Next up, Greyhound says competitors should be under state regulation. By Frank Van Leeuwen. From Durham. Upstart bus company Megabus has gotten a welcome reception from customers in search of shorter trips and low prices between Durham and the nation's capital. But the company's entree into North Carolina has Greyhound howling. Greyhound Lines is trying to block Megabus from serving routes within North Carolina, routes Greyhound has served for years. In a protest filed with the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which regulates transportation companies, Dallas, Texas-based Greyhound claims Megabus hasn't received regulatory approval to serve passenger routes within the state. Dale Moser, president and CEO of Chicago-based Megabus, says his company doesn't yet fall under state authority. When we go to Charlotte, Raleigh, it originates in Washington, D.C., so we operate under federal authority, he says. While Megabus has built a following in the Midwest, it's a newcomer to the Southeast, having only recently opened what it calls a hub operation in Washington, D.C. From there, Megabus offers a route from D.C. to Charlotte, with stops in Richmond and Durham. Megabuses offer fewer stops, and therefore quicker trips, and fares as low as $1. Fares rise as the buses fill up. Moser says the Greyhound Challenge in North Carolina is the first time a competing operator has filed an official complaint against his company. He says Megabus has federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration authorization to operate U.S. routes between states. If Megabus expands to add passenger transport within North Carolina, it would then need additional state approvals, he argues. Greyhound spokesman Tim Stokes declined to answer any questions, saying, the company would have nothing to say beyond what was stated in the Utilities Commission filing. In Greyhound's protest, Senior Vice President for Corporate Development Ted Burke calls on regulators to require Megabus to file details of its planned North Carolina operations. Burke says that, unlike Megabus's proposal here, Greyhound also provides scheduled passenger service at the smaller rural communities along those routes, not just at the major metropolitan centers. Greyhound is the Goliath of the U.S. bus industry, carrying 20 million passengers a year to 3,800 destinations in North America. Greyhound is a subsidiary of First Group, a United Kingdom-based transportation company with more than $9 billion in annual revenue. For the 6 months ended September 30th, First Group reported $4.6 billion in revenue. Greyhound's revenue in that period was $513 million, up 4% compared to the same period in 2009. Megabus is part of New Jersey-based transportation company Coach USA, which itself is a subsidiary of UK-based Stagecoach Group. For the 6 months ended October 30th, Stagecoach reported $1.7 billion in revenue, $240 million of it in North America. Stagecoach does not offer a breakdown for Megabus or other North American operations, but the company has stated that Megabus's expansion has driven revenue growth in North America. Megabus started in Chicago in 2006 and initially focused on the Midwest. The company now serves 50 Midwest and East Coast markets. Unlike Greyhound, which has a sprawling network of bus routes and terminals, Megabus opens hubs in large markets and chooses routes to feed those hubs. Besides Washington, the company's hubs are at New York, Philadelphia, Toronto, and Chicago. Moser says Megabus opened a North Carolina route only after research showed demand to support it. The low-cost carrier keeps expenses and ticket prices low by selling seats online only and by not operating any bus terminals, opting instead for pickups and drop-offs street-side or in parking lots. That means that even if Megabus adds additional North Carolina stops in the future, its operating costs and ticket prices on those routes should still be lower than Greyhound's. Up next, sensing a brokenness and wondering if it can be fixed. From In the Workplace, at the desk of Edward Marshall. It's a new year, and as I checked in with family and friends and colleagues, there seems to be a higher than usual prevalence of illness, from the common cold to surgeries. Looking for reasons, I learned that it was due to more than people just working harder than ever before. It was more than just the challenges of a difficult year economically. It was also more than all the change they experienced this last year and the virtual impossibility of absorbing its relentless speed. But even beyond these obvious stressors in our daily lives, some spoke of the chaos they felt all around them. Some spoke of the brokenness they see in families, institutions, and the world. Beyond that, they also expressed fear that we may not be able to fix it in this time. Not all of this brokenness. We live in a culture where we accept as the norm that we can fix anything if we just put our minds to it. We can reach the moon in 8 years if we are committed. We can cure cancer if we invest enough research. We can solve any business problem with the right strategy. But there seems to now be an increasing sense of despair that perhaps these new challenges are too big for us to fix. My colleagues pointed to the fact we are perched on the edge of the environmental tipping point. Unstoppable overpopulation, pervasive terrorism, and even the tenacity of joblessness. Where is the hope, they ask? There is hope inside each of us, just as there is despair. We get to choose which prevails. We get to accept our self-imposed limitations of belief that is this chaos and brokenness which cannot be healed, or we can reach down into our deep reservoir of faith and confidence and bring forth a hope that is tangible to others. We can inspire others if we can heal our own brokenness and cope with our own chaos. We can give others hope when we stand tall like an oak tree rooted deep in the ground, facing the winds of change with relentless resolve. We can find this hope inside ourselves when we remember that who we are as human beings, when we reflect on what truly matters in this short life of ours on this fragile planet. It's about love and trust, not fear and hate. It's about our connectedness to others and our shared struggle to find meaning in our lives and in our work. It's about our commitment to serve others and not just ourselves. At the end of the day, it's about our humanity and how we bring that humanity forth to others. It's a new year. We don't have to end this new year with illness. We can, in fact, end it with a new sense of wholeness and hope. I wish us all the very best on this journey into 2011 as we reflect, learn, choose, and lead. And now from the opinion page. Triangle will feel the impact of merger. From the editor's notebook, Sugura Mukirhi. Amazing start to a week. Threat of paralyzing snow and freezing rain, a heinous crime on a congresswoman in Arizona, followed by two of the biggest local business stories in recent years. Duke Energy buying Progress Energy and Red Hat opting to stay in Wake County and expand. While we all are at a loss in trying to understand the Arizona shootings, we somehow managed to get past the wintry weather during the week and resume our daily lives. But for thousands of people at Progress Energy, this only is the beginning of uncertainty. Without a doubt, the Duke acquisition is a big blow for the Triangle. Not only are we going to lose the headquarters of our only Fortune 500 company, The progress tentacles run wide and deep throughout our community. While the companies will operate separately until shareholders and regulators approve the deal, the merged company will have far fewer employees, and Raleigh's influence will be limited despite William Johnson's being at the helm following the merger. What will be of interest to all of us are the future electricity rates in the state, and that's where regulators can wield their influence on the deal. As part of the approval process, they should force Duke to lower rates for consumers. Progress's rates are higher than Duke's, and after subsidizing the consumer rates for the 3.1 million customers in Progress territory. The giant utility will have several benefits when it's merged, especially in getting better borrowing rates from Wall Street. And long term, the discounted rates will offer more savings than those achieved through attrition, layoffs, closure, and consolidation. Good bond rates will be important as the merged company expands its inventory of energy-producing plants, especially nuclear. Progress is expected to remain in its building in downtown Raleigh, but many of the corporate functions that deal with the charitable giving, sponsorships, and marketing programs most likely will be based in Charlotte. That does not bode well for Raleigh and Wake County. But what does bode well is what Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, said on January 10th. Red Hat will be staying in Raleigh and will be adding 540 jobs over the next few years, and the average salary of many of these jobs is more than $80,000 a year. The community owes you a big thanks, Mr. Whitehurst. It's really hard for all of us to comprehend how tough it must have been for Whitehurst and company to turn away millions of dollars in incentives and countless benefits from other states who made a full court press for this project. This was the big one, at least for the Southeast and the South, a world-renowned tech company that can jumpstart any state or area towards becoming a technology mega. Hopefully, one day Whitehurst will detail why he chose to stay in town. The local and state incentives offered to Red Hat pale in comparison to what would have happened to our core technology sector had Red Hat decided to leave. Want proof? Just wait until the Duke Progress merger is done. From the Triangle Business Journal's Biz column, it looks like Wake County residents hit hard by the economic downturn are finally beginning to recover their financial footing. The number of Wake County bankruptcies filed in the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in the Eastern District of North Carolina declined by about 8% to 2,730 in 2010. The filings are across all chapters and include both business and personal bankruptcies, with the vast majority of the filings being for personal bankruptcies. The pace of the filings dropped noticeably in the second half of 2010, when 1,369 bankruptcies were filed, a 16% decline from the same period in 2009. The Eastern District, in Wake's home district, while filings can be made outside of a county's home district, they are rare. Final stats for Durham and Orange counties in 2010 aren't available because the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Middle District of North Carolina hasn't reported its numbers for December. How would you like to buy a bunch of hockey tickets from the Carolina Hurricanes and then give them away to somebody else? Yeah, the Biz column knows it's kind of weird a sales pitch, but here's why the team is asking that question to local companies. The Canes are looking for sponsors for their annual Military Appreciation Night, in which local businesses donate reduced-price tickets to the state's military establishments. The team wants to provide 5,000 to 7,500 tickets to military personnel and their families for the March 12 game against the Columbus Blue Jackets. Sponsorship opportunities range from $5,000 to $10,000. Contact Kyle Prairie, who oversees ticket sales for the Canes, if you're interested in helping out. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.